Amazon introduced its first smartphone yesterday. It's called the Fire Phone, and the online retailer is eager to sell you one. But as NPR's Martin Kusty reports, Amazon's larger aim is to use the phone to sell you more of everything else.
It's been a rough few weeks for Amazon. Some authors have accused the company of using its dominance in ebooks to bludgeon publishers into accepting less money. It's even attracted the ire of Stephen Colbert.
I'm not just mad at Amazon, I am mad Prime. Because I just found out that they are deterring customers from buying books by Stephen Colbert.
But yesterday, the CEO, Jeff Bezos, ignored all that. Where the critics see a potential monopoly, Bezos celebrated the loyalty of Amazon customers. And he prefaced the launch of his new phone with an extended metaphor about buckets.
You can fill a bucket with an eyedropper if the bucket doesn't leak. And you can fill a bucket with a fire hose, but if the bucket leaks, it's still going to be empty tomorrow.
In other words, Amazon is eager to hold on to those loyal customers. And that's where this new smartphone comes in. The most eye-catching feature on the Fire Phone is a screen that simulates 3D.
We call this dynamic perspective.
The phone has cameras that track where you're looking, changing the perspective in the image as you move your head. It's especially appealing in games.
Look around on this image. So I'm tilting the phone to look everywhere at this level.
But from a business point of view, the phone's killer app may turn out to be Firefly. That's the one-button feature that lets you scan things in the physical world. Books, food products, toilet paper. And then the phone will identify that thing for you. If you're interested, you can buy that thing on the phone. Use this function enough, and Amazon is going to know a lot about you.
The questions I would ask are, what sort of information is going to be collected?
Jeremy Galula is a staff technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Is it going to be browsing information, location information, call history? I mean, what private information is going to be sort of reported back?
That kind of detailed information has been nearly impossible to come by for the company's earlier devices, such as the Kindle ebook. Cameron Janes is a director of product development at Amazon.
We really respect customers' privacy, and so we have lots of, you know, if you don't want your data shared, you can turn data off, for instance.
But not shared, but can I keep it from going back to Amazon?
You can choose not to use certain features if you don't want to. We think those features are great and add a lot of value to the customer experience, but of course you always have the option not to do that.
Of course, that doesn't leave many options for people who would like to use those features if they could know which data are being sent to Amazon as part of the deal. And it's not just Amazon. Tech companies are usually reluctant to disclose the details about the information they collect. It's their secret sauce. But Jeremy Galula says when a smartphone is made by a retailer, those questions become more pressing.
I mean, it basically comes down to Amazon is trying to sell things, and it's very similar to the way Google is trying to sell ads. I mean, Amazon is just sort of one step closer to that because they're selling it to you directly.
So if you end up buying the Fire Phone for its cool 3D screen, Jeff Bezos hopes you'll also end up feeling comfortable inside of Amazon's bucket. Martin Kusty, NPR News, Seattle.
We want to begin the program today talking about Iraq. Militants attacked and now reportedly control much of the northern part of the country, and violence continues to spread. By now, you may have heard of ISIS, the militant group behind the recent violence. It's a group of Sunni fighters that want to create an Islamic empire across the Middle East. We wanted to hear more about how this group is gaining ground in Iraq using part social media tactics and obviously violence, and what its rise there could mean for the rest of the Middle East. Joining us now to talk more about it is Shadi Hamid. He's the Brookings Institution Fellow for the Project on U.S.-Islamic World Relations, and his new book is called Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also here in the studio is Nadia Owadat. She's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and researches youth and internet in the Arab Spring. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shadi, I'm going to start with you, give you a little advantage because you're on the phone here. Refresh our memories about exactly who ISIS is and how this group came to flourish in Iraq.
Sure. So ISIS is actually a product of previous conflicts. They gained a lot of ground in the Syrian conflict, and they actually became so extreme that Al-Qaeda Central disavowed them. No one's more vicious and brutal in their tactics and in their harsh implementation of Sharia law than ISIS. But ISIS is different in the sense it's not like old-style Al-Qaeda, 9/11, and after that, where it was pretty much about destroying things. ISIS has been able to control territory. It's trying to govern. It's providing security for citizens, often in a very harsh way. But it is a bit of a different model than the kind of terrorist blowing up model that I think a lot of Americans were used to previously.
And Nadia, I want to talk a little bit more about this because obviously there is a very rocky connection between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And as we just heard Shadi say, that Al-Qaeda sort of rejects the ISIS theology. But
is
that true?
Actually.
Yeah. What's the connection there?
Basically, what happened between ISIS and Al-Qaeda is really a power play. There's a lot of big egos from within the jihadi scene, and they're competing for power. And somebody refused to give blind obedience to Baghdadi, who is now the head of ISIS. He ridiculed Dawahiri, and he wanted actually to assassinate Al-Qaeda, all of their members in Syria. So you have somebody who's so brutal, he cannot tolerate dissent. So it really is a power play. It really is a group that does wants to rule alone. It's very authoritarian. So it's not so much that they are too violent for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has no problem killing civilians. It killed with cold blood 3,000 plus civilians. It really is about who's in control. And we will see this go on because there's so much infighting, in fact, that is now being covered by Wiki Baghdadi, basically somebody from within leaking this infighting. But you can see it happened in Afghanistan. It happened again in Iraq, which caused the Sahwa councils. It happened in Syria, and it will happen also in Iraq.
Shadi, I want to talk more about this. You just heard Nadia saying Wiki Baghdadi, which is someone releasing documents from inside ISIS. But this gets at the issue of Sunni extremism and Sunni militants. Who exactly is the constituency for ISIS within Iraq? Who's really supporting this group?
Sure. Well, I think we're entering a Salafi jihadi moment, if you will, where more moderate Islamist groups across the Middle East have lost popularity. They tried to come to power through democratic elections, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but for a variety of reasons, that didn't work out so well. So now we're seeing these jihadist groups that are quite violent, and they're essentially saying to their constituents that violence works. Violence is the only way. Democratic elections are a waste of time. And that has some appeal, but I think more generally, in a place like Iraq, you have such anger at the central government, which is dominated by the Maliki government, which is Shia. So there's a real sectarian element where they look at Maliki and they can't stand him, so they're being pushed into the arms of Sunni extremist groups. Now, if these Iraqis live under ISIS rule, they might change their mind, but at least in this initial phase, there has been some embrace on the local level of these Sunni militants. And it's not just ISIS, but also a number of other smaller groups as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about recent violence in Iraq and the rise of the militant group ISIS. With us now, that's Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Institution. And now here's Nadia Owidat of the New America Foundation. And Nadia, I gather you have a slightly different take on sort of where the moderates are in all of this.
I do. If I may first comment on my colleague's observation. You know, we've actually never had democracy in the Arab world. We've never had equal citizenship. And even when the Brotherhood were in power, they very much disenfranchised everybody else. So I would not say that this Salafi jihadist movement is a reaction to the fail of democracy, because democracy never actually took place.
You're talking about a liberal democracy the way maybe Americans
exactly,
think of it.
Right. But what is happening in Iraq, he's definitely right about the government of Maliki, which could not possibly be part of the solution. If the U.S. thinks that it can wrap this problem with Maliki, they are really not in touch with reality, because Maliki is so unpopular, he is so part of the problem, that he is causing sworn enemies to be united against him. Sufis, who are, again, all jihadists from their inception in the 80s, were very much against Sufis. And Baathis, they were, when I was reading Al-Qaeda papers that came out of Afghanistan, the Baathists were number one enemy, sworn enemy to Al-Qaeda. And both are uniting with ISIS against Maliki's government and practices. So Maliki cannot be part of the solution. On the moderates, if you look, for example, 80% of the Arab world is under 40, and 70% is under 30, and most of whom are not married. If you look at the most popular Facebook pages, the most popular YouTube channels, they're very secular. They're very, very much secular. The top five, for example, Facebook pages include following Hollywood movies, includes National Geographic in Abu Dhabi, so includes one page called Educate Yourself. So this does not reflect the inclination of the majority, but they do reflect funding and support by certain groups to such tendencies.
Obviously, there's going to be more conversation about those sectarian divisions over the coming weeks, and you are hearing lawmakers talk more and more about whether Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki should go. I want to jump on something you mentioned there, Nadia, though, about social media. Obviously, social media has been very popular with Islamist extremists around the region. Shadi Hamid, what does ISIS do differently? Why do they stand out?
Yeah, so I think the important thing about social media to understand is, you know, when the Arab Spring started, there was a lot of excitement that these are young English-speaking revolutionaries who are using Twitter and Facebook, and we saw technology as being part of this great future. But the point about social media is that the bad guys can use it too, including terrorists in this case. And they've been able to have a presence on Twitter and Facebook and to be able to distribute their messages in real time to a larger audience through a variety of different accounts. It's hard to always track which account belongs to which group and so on, but the presence is definitely there. We've seen jihadists more generally post 9/11 really being able to adapt to new kinds of technology. I mean, these are some pretty technologically savvy guys as retrograde as they might otherwise be.
Yeah, just to let Nadia jump in here, I mean, this is a group that has hashtag campaigns. They had an app in the Android store. What are they doing here that's so striking?
Well, actually, again, all jihadists, and in fact, political Islam in general, have always been media conscious, have always paid extra attention to their picture in the media, to their propaganda. So they've had 20 years to really hone their skills and really be good at it. But I want to say that because of that, they were, in fact, most of the time ahead of the game. They were the one who were monopolizing the internet in Arabic. So a few years ago, the only thing you could see in Arabic, in addition to maybe some newspaper websites, is Islamist and jihadist and Wahhabi content. That's it. It monopolized. The new development, in fact, is not that, oh, they are using the internet. The new development is that, oh, the internet is also now being used by liberal forces and human rights forces. And in fact, they are, again, they have way more audience. It's important to keep that in mind, that if you look at the entire presence, they are losing, in fact. They don't have, they're not even close to being popular by even a big minority.
But they've certainly drawn tremendous attention with some of the grisly videos that they've posted execution and people trying to verify this. I mean, they're very savvy.
Are very brutal. And in fact, their brutality shows how disconnected they are from the wider Arab audience. Because if they think this will gain them popularity, they are truly disconnected.
Shadi?
If I could just jump in. Yeah, I'm not sure if popularity really matters to these groups. They're not trying to be these mass populist movements that are well-liked and adored. They believe that violence works, in the sense they instill fear in the local populations, and that creates for them a better situation as they see it, where they're able to control. And so if you judge it based on that, there has actually been considerable success. I mean, we're talking about a very large swath of territory in Iraq and Syria that are governed directly by these groups. Liberals can't claim that anywhere in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, the more moderate Islamist groups haven't been able to claim territory either. So, I mean, unfortunately, we're living in a time and in a region where violence works. That's the sad fact of it.
I'm sorry. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Shadi Hamid is a Brookings Fellow for the Project on U.S.-Islamic World Relations. His new book is called Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. He joined us from Oslo, where he's traveling. And Nadia Ouedat, she's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and researches youth and internet in the Arab Spring. She was with us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office called the Washington Redskins' name disparaging to Native Americans and canceled the team's trademark registration. We'll dig into sports law and find out just what this might mean for the league and the controversial team name. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
Watching live music online is nothing new, but if you want to catch certain acts from the comfort of your home, you may need to buy a ticket, or at least a virtual one. Jeffrey Pepper Rogers reports that more and more musicians are staging online concerts as a way to make money.
At midnight on a Wednesday, the young Irish singer Janet Devlin kicks off an acoustic show. She's in London, but her audience is all over, from Norway to South Africa to the U.S. A few hundred fans have paid $8 to watch online, and some have been chatting with each other for hours, and even leaving tips of $10 and $25 for Devlin before she sang a note.
I don't care if Monday's blue, Tuesday's gray, and Wednesday's too. Thursday, I don't care about you, it's Friday, I'm in love.
This concert is on a website called Stage It. The technology for streaming live events has been around for years, but StageIt and another site, Concert Window, have made it easy to play online shows and make money doing it. This is good news for musicians hit hard by the plunge in royalties and CD sales, says singer-songwriter Christine Lavin.
I'm intrigued with the idea that the internet, that has really hurt a lot of us financially, has now opened up a new avenue for ways we can make some of that money back by connecting us to audience members who are not in the same town where we are.
Sitting in that town in New Mexico, named after a game show.
For artists, online concerts can help fill the gaps between regular gigs. Folk rock songwriter Dan Byrne plays StageIt shows when he's at home in L.A. or has downtime on the road.
You know, I've been touring for so long and I've run myself ragged sometimes going from place to place, and suddenly here's a venue where, in a sense, everybody comes to me. Or I suppose I come to them too, but without having to put any gas in the car or jump on a plane.
The appeal is the same for fans. Sherry Kennedy often travels a long way from home in Ohio to see Dan Byrne and appreciates being able to catch him online.
I love that I don't have to get ready and I can just cuddle up on my couch with my dog and watch the show with whoever I want to watch it with.
I don't mind.
A laptop concert is an unusual sort of experience. The performer can't see or hear the audience, but can read their chat and questions. There's a lag time that makes it tough to have a normal conversation. Yet it feels very intimate.
Oh, I spy with my little eye.
One of the keys to Stage It and Concert Window is that shows are not recorded. Evan Lowenstein, the founder of Stage It, is clear that he is not in the record business.
What we like to say at StageIt is that we are a company in the music space that doesn't sell music, we sell time. And the mere fact that fans know that time is money, they're willing to pay.
In fact, fans seem willing to pay significantly more when it's their own choice. Concert Window used to have a $5 set price for tickets. As soon as the site gave the option to pay what you want, people started paying almost twice as much per ticket. Dan Gurney, a Celtic accordion player, is co-founder of Concert Window.
This is how the music industry is going to grow again. It's through flipping that equation and asking people, how much is music worth to you and how much do you want to support it?
I'm not gonna write you a love song, 'cause you asked for it, 'cause you need one. You see, I'm not gonna write you.
It's free to play a show on Concert Window or Stage It, and performers range from little-known acts to big names like Sarah Bareilles or Jimmy Buffett. The sites take about a third of the proceeds from tickets and tips. Stage It makes tipping a bit like a game show. Top tippers win prizes like signed posters or Skype sessions, and superfans often tip hundreds of dollars or more, says Evan Lowenstein.
You know, the larger artists, we've seen people make over $50,000 in 30 minutes just from a laptop. In fact, our biggest show to date is about $66,000. I think that number really started to turn heads in the industry.
At this point, it's hard to say how the emergence of online concerts will affect offline performing. Christine Lavin is one artist who believes they can be complementary.
I don't think that this would ever replace live performing. I think this is just a whole new way to connect us up with people. And my feeling is, if people like what they see at these live shows that are on your screen, that if we come to your town, they will come out and see us live, I hope.
As for the Irish singer Janet Devlin, she's using the money from online concerts to help take her band out on the road. For NPR News, I'm Jeffrey Pepper Rogers.
The Supreme Court this week agreed to hear a case about a man who threatened on Facebook to kill his wife. He was arrested and tried. His lawyers say that he never intended to do it. He was just venting after a bad breakup. As the nation's top court considers his actions, Facebook executives are also puzzling over how to deal with threatening speech on the social media platform. NPR's Arthi Shahani has more.
Anthony Ilonis got dumped and lost his job.
He took to Facebook as what he says, a form of therapy.
Criminologist Rob DeVideo at Drexel University is following the case. And by therapy, he means threats, which Ilonis made repeatedly on Facebook to his ex, to law enforcement, and as life kept falling apart, to an unspecified elementary school.
Ilonis was sentenced to 44 months in prison and 3 years of supervised community release.
Ilonis's wife said she felt scared. His defense says the graphic language was a joke. Take this one post DeVideo reads out loud.
Did you know that it's illegal for me to say I want to kill my wife?
Ilonis claims he lifted the lines from a comedy called The Whitest Kids You Know.
Hi, I'm Trevor Moore. Did you know that it's illegal to say I want to kill the President of the United States of America?
The Supreme Court will consider if Ilonis' language was a true threat, which the lower court defined as speech that is so clearly objectionable, any objective listener could be scared. Meanwhile, the company Facebook has already decided that keywords are not an effective way to look for threats on the site.
Especially the things that get reported for the more intense reasons are things that you look at the text and it's like, I had no idea from looking at this text that this was going on.
Arturo Bejar is director of engineering at Facebook. While the platform has hard and fast rules against porn, it does not forbid specific violent words. While algorithms crawl through the site in search of our deepest consumer demands, there's no algorithm looking for credible threats. That's because, Bejar says,
intent and perception really matter.
Bejar's little-known section of the Facebook machine works on conflict resolution. He's gone to leading universities and recruited experts in linguistics and compassion research. Together, they field user complaints about posts at a massive scale.
We facilitate approximately 4 million conversations a week.
By conversation, he really does mean getting people to communicate directly with each other, not just complain anonymously. It's couples therapy light for the social media age. And it turns out, a button that says report is a real conversation killer.
We were talking to teenagers, and it turns out they didn't like clicking on report because they were worried that they would get a friend in trouble.
When his team changed it to a softer phrase, this post is a problem, complaints shot up. They also revamped the automated form so that the person complaining names the recipient and the emotion that got triggered.
Hey, Artie, this photo that you shared with me is embarrassing to me.
More people started to complain, and according to the data, the word embarrassing really works.
There's a 83 to 85% likelihood that the person receiving the message is going to reply back or take down the photo.
Facebook has several hundred employees around the world who can step in when the automated tools fail, and threat detection is clearly a work in progress. Consider two cases. In the first, Facebook user Sarah Lubsack complained about a picture that a friend posted of his naked butt.
It wasn't the most attractive rear end I've ever seen, but also just not what I wanted to see as I browsed Facebook.
And how long did it take for them to take the picture down?
Oh, not long at all. It was maybe a couple of hours.
User Francesca Sampson complained about a post that she says put her safety at risk. She recently had flowers delivered to her mom after a surgery.
So she posted a picture of the flowers, and the card had my full name, my address, and my cell phone number on it. And it was open to the public. It wasn't just limited to her friends.
Sampson says her mom wouldn't delete the post because she wanted to show off the bouquet, and Facebook wouldn't get involved in family matters. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
Ken Regan is a kind of chess detective. He's a computer scientist and an international chess master who played with the likes of Bobby Fischer as a kid, which gives him particular skills to help recognize cheating in chess, which he says is becoming more common. Ken Regan has created a new algorithm to help detect chess cheating. He's profiled this month in U.S. Chess Magazine and joins us now from Buffalo. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, I must say, when your work was first explained to me, there was a part of me that wondered if chess cheating was just a matter of somebody going, you know, hey, Katy Perry's over there and upsetting
the
board.
Yes, yes. Well, not quite. People don't distract and then take a rook off the board. That doesn't happen.
So how does somebody cheat in chess?
The most common way is having the game on your smartphone or handheld device and going into the bathroom surreptitiously to check it.
Hmm. So people are consulting their smartphones because there are algorithms that will tell them what the propitious next move is?
Yes, there are chess engines that are very strong, stronger than any human player, apparently even running on the reduced hardware of a smartphone.
I mean, shouldn't this be pretty easy to detect? I can't imagine that you need to be Sherlock Holmes to see if somebody is consulting their iPhone while they're playing a chess game.
Well, that's been true in some cases. People have had behavior that's suspected and they've been followed and caught. Mm-hmm. But in the case in Dortmund, Germany last August, it was very subtle. You had to notice that the person had his left hand in his pocket and was doing a little fingering with the fingers. If you're not watching closely, you might not see this.
Mm. Is part of the rise in chess cheating due to the fact that, if I can put it this way, computers are becoming more accomplished at chess too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, 17 years ago, Garry Kasparov fell to a supercomputer, but now the saying is that your iPad today is as good as a supercomputer was 20 years ago. So put the two together, and that kind of power, as well as improved chess algorithms, is at everyone's fingertips.
Explain the kind of algorithm that you're talking about. Help guide us through it.
Different chess positions have different character. Some have just a single move for you to stay in the game or a single move to keep your advantage. Mm-hmm. When that's the case, a strong chess player is highly likely to find such a move, as will the computer, so you'll get a match. So when there's a case where a person says, wow, this guy made a lot of moves that are just like the computer, I analyze the game and say, well, was it a forcing game? Were most of these moves ones that most people would find? And my model will spit out a number that says yes, and therefore this is not a great deviation. In other cases, it'll say, whoa, wait a second, this is a much higher correspondence than these positions would allow.
Professor Regan, how do you analyze these games? How do you keep track of them?
Well, one of the great things about chess is the entire record of play is part of the public record. So I can feed the moves into a computer, and the computer will analyze them.
Well, what are the odds of somebody being falsely accused?
I deal with accusations, whispers, public statements, grouses that people make. And usually my model shows, no, this play really was within expectation. The other side is, yes, it's a great danger that this statistics might falsely accuse someone. As a fail-safe, I have taken data, many millions of pages of data, from the entire history of chess, including all the performances by Bobby Fischer and Garry Kasparov. So I have an idea of the distribution of what happens by nature.
Ken Regan, chess detective and computer science professor at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, the video game industry's biggest convention. The old stereotype that gamers are all nerdy white men, well, there was truth to that. A survey 9 years ago found that 83% of the people making video games were white men, and the vast majority of college students studying computer science and video game art are men. Even today, a Kaiser Family Foundation study found that nearly 9 out of every 10 video game protagonists are white men. But in recent years, some in the industry say things are really changing, that interactive games incorporate sophisticated narratives like never before, that games are now directed at and are being played by a much more diverse group, no longer the domain of the nerdy white guy. So we came to this showcase of what the gaming world has in store to see how the industry is going to deliver on those promises. That's our cover story today. E3 is massive and bright and colorful and loud. Sensory overload doesn't quite cover it. In spite of all the noise and spectacle, none of the new games here seemed that new. A lot of sequels to Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty, Mario Kart, a repackaging of Halo, and lots of ultra-violence. The most exciting place at E3 was actually the quietest, a room above the crowded convention floor. Here they're demonstrating a game about as far as you can get from a first-person shooter. It's called Adrift, and it's being developed for the virtual reality platform Oculus Rift. You may have heard of Oculus Rift. They were recently acquired in a huge deal by Facebook. I have the chance to try on the goggles that Mark Zuckerberg was willing to pay $2 billion for.
Cool. So yeah, when you pop this on, you'll find yourself in the game world environment. Basically, have a look around, get your bearings.
And I am in outer space.
Have a good look down at your feet.
Oh my. I'm an astronaut, floating in a spaceship or space station that's been damaged. All I can hear is my breathing and Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata. There's the Earth. There's Mexico right below me. It's incredible, unlike any VR headset I've tried. My brain is processing the input like it's real sense data. It's really amazing. I actually feel a bit of vertigo. Adam Orth is the creator of Adrift.
The goal of the game is to A, survive, and B, get home safely.
Honestly, I don't care about the goal of the game. I was just so excited to be in outer space. I could happily spend hours just exploring the environment. But here's the weirdest part of the experience. I had this deeply emotional feeling of being transported, an intensity I'd never felt before in a game. Orth says he wants to harness that emotion to take gamers beyond the standard violent action games.
And there's nothing wrong with those games. They're great. I love them, and I've made them, and I play them. But I don't want to make them anymore, and I want to tell emotional stories, and that device is allowing me to tell them in a way that I was not able to do it before.
It's kind of a buzzkill to go back to the convention floor. The noise of firearms and explosions. Mostly white male attendees playing almost entirely white male characters. Megan Farokmanesh writes for Polygon, a gaming news site.
To the outside world, video games are violence and men doing that violence. And I think that that's a really good way to push anybody out that would be interested in it.
Past E3 press conferences have been roundly criticized for the lack of diversity. This year, out of dozens of presenters, there were 5 women and 3 people of color. An improvement, to be sure, but not great. One Polygon headline announced that during the big press conferences, there were more severed heads in game demos than female presenters.
I think it's getting a little bit better in recent years because people are finally starting to pay attention to it and starting to make it a big deal where it hasn't been so much before.
And the tradition of booth babes, the hot models who draw attendees to displays, that's dying out. None of the major companies have them anymore. Women make up nearly half of video gamers, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation study. But that covers not just console games like Call of Duty, but social games like Farmville on Facebook and mobile games like Candy Crush. Looking around at E3, it's tough to imagine the console players are really half women. Polygon's managing editor, Justin McElroy, says the current system is self-perpetuating.
Dudes are playing video games. Dudes are making video games. Dudes are putting dudes in the games for the dudes to play. Anything that goes against that is going to be work.
But some independent companies are taking on that hard work, like the Spanish game studio Tequila Works.
I'd say that our studio is a bit different.
Risa Cohen is the executive producer for Tequila Works.
I'd say for the last 20 years that I've been working in video games, it has been pretty white and pretty male.
Raul Rubio is CEO and creative director at the company.
We have, for example, 11 nationalities here, 4 sexual orientations, and 3 different religions.
Together, Raul and Risa have loaded Tequila Works with top-level talent, like their lead animator, a woman with serious chops from LucasArts and Pixar. Right now, they're working on a game called Rhyme. Like the last game I tried, you start off in Rhyme trying to make sense of and survive a bewildering situation, in this case, washing ashore on a mysterious desert island. But this isn't virtual reality, and you see the character you're portraying. It's a striking contrast to any video game hero I've seen before. This one is a child, maybe 8 or 9. You can't tell if it's a boy or girl. Long black hair and brown skin. Again, Risa Cohen.
Someone wrote to us and said it's so refreshing to see a character that's not, you know, this big muscle white man, that we've got, you know, a kind of small, long-haired, brown-skinned, lanky-leg character.
Raul says people were entranced by the promise of a game that bucks the trend of violence.
This is a game with no combat at all. This is not about the shooting. Quite the opposite. It's about discovering and feeling that all things can look new and mysterious.
There's no set release date for Rhyme or for the Oculus Rift platform, so the revolution in video games may be coming just a little later than advertised.